Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
If you use the Deer Creek light with Deer Creek material or Loon light with Loon material, it should go 100%. But even then, I don't really notice it get to 100%. So when you get put in the sun has every light spectrum that you need. And so it definitely cures it completely. And so it takes away that almost... it makes it feel correct. It doesn't feel wet and slippery. It feels slippery because it's just a slippery material, and it doesn't feel tacky, like it didn't dry all the way. It feels like it's dry.
That was Garrett Lesko sharing one of his Euronymph tie-in tips. Garrett's top 11 today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. If you can, please take a moment and leave a 5-star review if you have listened to this show and been getting some value over the past years or weeks. Head over to wetflyswing.com/love, where you can easily click and leave a review. And if you do this now, I'm going to send you a free hat, a Wet Fly Swing hat, and a sticker if you leave a review and send me a screenshot. So all you gotta do is just take a screenshot and share it with me via email or on Instagram at wetflyswing. That would be amazing. And while you're at it, why not just like wetflyswing? If you jump over there on Instagram, that would be amazing. Appreciate you and your support. Garrett Lesko, a young fly tying phenom from the past, digs into Euronymph tying tips today. We heard about his baby bird fly, his top 11 nymphs for your nymphing, and a ton of resources that helped him get going really fast. And they're still awesome resources. We kind of cover everything you can imagine today as far as resources online. So without further ado, here is Garrett Lesko.
How's it going, Garrett?
Going well. How are you, Dave?
Good. Good. You ready to, we're going to jump into some Euro. I think the Euro nymphing is obviously always a hot topic whenever we do big episodes on this. And we haven't done specifically fly tying, and I think we're going to try to dig into that today. We've had a few people like Devin Olson, and just recently had Tom Jarman on, where we talked more about tactics of fishing, but you know, we haven't dug into the fly. So I want to do that today. Maybe think of it as, you know, I don't know if there are like a top 10 flies or some of the big ones out there as we go through this. But before we get into that, because obviously you do a lot of that fly tying, talk about how you first got into fly fishing.
Yeah, so I first got into fly fishing, I forget the times now because it's been a fair amount of time. I started when I was a freshman in high school, and so I just turned 26. So it's been anywhere between like 12 to 13 years, and I had a buddy of mine, we went on a trip through my school. We went to Odell Lake, if you're familiar with Oregon Lake. So we went to Odell to do fish for kokanee, and he ended up bringing his fly rod and brought it along on the trip to fish like Odell Creek and fish around the mouth. He brought a float tube and stuff like that. And I just thought it was really cool. And so it kind of planted the seed. And then later that summer, I found a fly tying kit, like an old Thompson fly tying kit, like the original kit. And so it had the original like C-clamp vise and some old scissors in it, and then like the original bobbin. And so I was like, oh, I'll try to tie a fly. And I cut off deer hair off of like spinners and used like sewing thread. It was terrible, but luckily I had a local fly shop where I grew up in Albany, Two Rivers Fly Shop, and he sold custom like beginner kits. So I bought that, and then I had the buddy come over from school and show me how to kind of tie a woolly bugger. And that was kind of the gateway into it, and then I just really, really, really liked it. I was already into fishing, did a lot of like conventional fishing in general. Like I got really into like conventional bass fishing, and you know, I started off with a bobber and the worm, or the sinker and a worm for like stock or trout, and then went up to conventional bass fishing and got really into that. And then the fly fishing just grabbed me and took me like unbelievably like tight. Like it just clicked really, really, really well. And so I started tying flies like everything I could find online, because I was 14 at the time, 13, 14 years old. I didn't have a car, I didn't have a job, so I didn't have any money. And so it's not like I could go to like a fly tying class, and the resources are limited anyways in general. And so I was like, well, I can go to the library. So I went to the library a bunch and got like books. I learned a ton of stuff online, YouTube videos. So I watched a lot of stuff from like the Caddis Fly Shop, Tightline Productions, South Dakota Anglers and Outfitters. I'm trying to think, I forget his name, but there's a guy out there that does a bunch of fly tying stuff. And then Fly Fish Food wasn't, I don't think it was Fly Fish Food at the point. I think it was just Curtis Fry, because he had YouTube videos. They've been doing YouTube videos for well over a decade now, but they weren't Fly Fish Food at the time. It was just Curtis doing fly tying videos with Clark, Cheech, and they were at. So I watched their videos. I just watched stuff on YouTube, and like Davey McPhail was a big influence for me, and then Jay Nicholas from Caddis Fly was huge, because he was down in Eugene and he was tying flies, so it felt very accessible. And so I started tying everything I could get my hands on. And some of these patterns, I was tying more intermediate to advanced patterns when I really didn't know the basics. And so I realized the patterns did not look like what I wanted them to look like. They weren't as clean, they weren't as neat, they weren't as tidy. And so I went, oh, I need to figure this out. So I bought a fly box with the limited money I had and used the limited materials I had and just kind of did the basics. I found a bunch of old school patterns and just learned how to tie those as well as I possibly could. So I tied like, I think I did a box. It was like an old Umpqua foam double-sided box, and it had pheasant tails and hare's ears and bird's nests and like dubbing caddis, like very simple flies, but just to kind of hone in the basics. And when I filled that box, I used them when I went fishing and they caught fish, and I found out, oh, I don't have to use the most advanced, newest fly with the craziest material and the advanced techniques. I can just keep it very simple. And so, but once you learn those simple techniques, the more advanced flies became more accessible and easier, and they looked better. And so, did a ton of fly tying, got into like trout flies and fly fishing, because that's kind of what fly fishing's really designed for, is catching trout. And so now, but because, as I mentioned previous to you, I was really in the conventional bass fishing world with conventional tackle. And so I thought, oh, well, can't I fish for bass on a fly rod? And at the time, at least, probably 8 years ago, 9 years ago, it was still very niche. There wasn't a lot of guys fly fishing for bass at all. There's just, there's a couple blog posts here, a couple videos there, and they essentially just said use a woolly bugger, a Clouser minnow, or a popper. And that was it. That's all the information that they give you. They wouldn't tell you how a bass eats and how a bass does this and what kind of flies to use and what are they targeting on. Everyone just was very basic because fly guys just didn't care. And so I started combining conventional tackle, info, reading old books, looking at articles from like Bass Resource and other like most competitive bass fishing worlds, and then combine them. And then I kind of discovered stacked deer hair. And that's, if most people know me, I'm probably most known for doing stacked deer hair flies. So like at expos and shows, that's what I do. So I'm tying stuff like birds and divers and frogs and sliders, and
Right.
very
Kind of
much
like the Pat Cohen style.
absolutely. Yeah, he's a big influence. So I spent probably a year tying really, really terrible spun deer hair flies. And then I got Pat Cohen's DVD. I got one of his, not one of his first runs, but maybe his second or third run, Fugly Packers, like even before Hairline carried them. So I got them a long time ago, and I still have it. It's an awesome tool. It's bulletproof. But I got all his stuff. I got everything he needed off his website, was totally hook, line, and sinker into it. and I still wasn't quite getting it. And then when I went to one of the expos, the Albany show, the big one, I became friends with a guy named Sean West, who's out of Washington, and he does stacked ear hair stuff. It's as good as Pat Cohen, but it's a totally different style. It's much smaller stuff. It's not as big. Like Pat Cohen's time flies in like the 4-aught, 6-aught size, where Sean ties stuff more in like, I think the biggest one he ties is like a size 2. It's very interesting, but it's all smallmouth stuff because he lives up near the Columbia, so he fishes for smallmouth. And he's super, super nice, and he sat me down as a – I might have even still been a teenager at the time – sat me down in front of him with my own vise and my own stuff, and he stacked a fly with me, like just one-on-one at the show, which was really cool. And then that's when everything just started clicking. And so I spent probably a full year from that moment till the next expo tying barely enough flies that I needed to go trout fishing and catch like a couple smallmouth here and there. And then I spent the rest of the year just tying as many deer hair stack flies as I could. And I got really good at it. At least that's what I've been told. I don't want to toot my own horn too much, but I got really good at it. And so I started doing it more and more and more. And then obviously as you put more time into it, you get better and better at it. And then I started tying birds, and like one of the first birds I tied, I think, if you're familiar with H&H Outfitters, I'm friends with Alex, the guy who owns it. And so I stopped by his shop one time and I dropped off one of the flies because he was getting really into like bass fishing up around the Portland area, because that's where the shop was located at the time. And I look back at it now and I cringe because it was not the best looking bird fly, but that was kind of where I was starting and I was going into it. And when Pat Cohen released that, I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And so I tied them because I thought they looked cool. And then I really started tying them when I saw a bass at a local pond here in Oregon eat a duckling. Like it looked like someone flushed the toilet on a duck and it just sucked it down. And I was like, okay, I was like, all right, this isn't just like a Midwest thing. This isn't just like pike eating ducklings or like big Florida bass doing it. This is bass will just eat them. And so I started tying them for fishing. And one of my big things that, like, if I tie flies for people around here, the big place people want to tie, like, have a bird fly is Davis Lake over in Central Oregon, because it's a fly fish only lake and it's has a great bass, like largemouth population. And one of the big things that bass eat are little baby red winged blackbirds that fall into the tules that are like around the entire lake. It's like very swampy around the rim of these Cascade Lakes. So Davis not the exception. And so you can go in there like really early in the morning or late in the evening and throw these birds because they have, you know, heavy duty weed guards. They're designed to be thrown into cover. You can throw them deep into the cover and then just work them through there, and you can get bass that'll come up and take them. And so it's pretty awesome. And then I've tied birds for people like going to, I think he went to Christmas Island, but he's going after GTs. And because of that very viral Blue Planet video that came out of giant trevally eating those seabirds, he wanted birds. So I tied one of the biggest flies ever, like biggest deer hair flies. It was a 6-aught stacked deer hair, like blackbird, all black.
Where can you see that fly? Anywhere online? Do you have it out there on your site or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, on my social media, I have, if you just scroll through it, you can find it.
On Instagram?
Yeah, on Instagram. And then if you go to my website, Oregon Fly Tying, it should be one of the banner photos or something like that. Like, I have one, I just scrolled down my Instagram just now, just a couple rows. And back in March, I posted like a duckling in a nest that I did at a show.
Oh yeah, I see it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's it. So that little yellow, olive yellow, kind of. That's it.
So that's like a duckling sized one. I don't know if that's a reasonable size, but
it's something like that. One. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. And so then I just scaled it up. I used like a big A-Rex pike hook, and it was a feat to undertake. I was impressed that I was able to do it, but. Yeah, it was one of those ones where it's like, I don't know if I could do this that often. Then I got, I found Euronymphing, oh gosh, probably 3-4 years ago, and didn't like it, didn't do much of it. And then I started watching Lance Egan and Devin Olson's Modern Nymphing videos, and that really helped me get into the technique better, and I just kind of taken that and ran. And so if you're scrolling through the same social media, you'll see like the Euro nymphs that I've been tying. Like, I fill boxes and boxes of them, and it's awesome. I love nymph fishing with like an indicator, you know, learning how to fly fish, and Euro nymphing is just like the advanced version of that. And it's, I really like doing it.
I'm glad you mentioned the Euro nymphs. I was wanting to dig into that a little bit, especially as you look at your stuff here. You have, and we might circle around back on the bass if we have time, but maybe you can just start us off with the Euro nymphs and talk about how, you know, if somebody wanted to tie some, let's just think about the fly tying of the Euro nymphs. What, because they seem like they're really basic, but can you walk us through just the steps of what it takes to tie one? I don't know if you want to pick a fly or something like that and just talk about generally what it is.
Yeah. So I'll start with probably the most entry level one. It was kind of my entry level into it. I mean, I tied Euro nymphs before it without knowing what I was tying. Like, one of the first Euro nymphs I tied was a Polish pheasant tail, which is, I think, the most popular video on Davy McPhail's YouTube page. And so, but I've never seen it tied commercially, and I've never seen it tied, like, I've never seen it in like a shop. I don't hear many people talking about it, surprisingly. But probably the most entry level one for most people is like a Frenchie, Lance Egan Frenchie. And so, It's very simple, but some of the main concepts for a Euro nymph, there's some concepts that people need to dial in, and I see this all the time. I'm in a lot of Facebook groups, at least it feels like a lot, probably a dozen or more active, like really active Facebook groups. And you'll see a lot of flies get tied, and even some of my flies, I'll look back at them and go, well, I could probably have done better. But one of the big things that they talk about is thin on these flies, keep them as thin as possible. And I equated that as, oh, I can make them dense and overcompensate the lack of thinness. So if, for example, if I have lead wire underneath them and then a very thin body over the top, that's a very dense fly. So it should sink really quickly. And it does, it sinks faster than a conventional fly because it has a tungsten bead and lead wire and it's dense. But in reality, even thinner flies with less weight will sink faster. And so that's something that I've just learned over time and seen reinforced through other people's, you know, experiences, either competing or fishing on their own or talking about it on their platforms and things like that. And so when it comes to tying a Euro nymph, the big thing is tungsten beads. That's probably the most that's probably the biggest roadblock getting into this because of the cost. Tungsten beads are very expensive compared to brass beads. You can buy a 24 pack of Hairline Cyclops beads for, I don't know, probably $3, right, Dave? I don't know how much brass beads are.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know. I've got so many beads. I don't even have to buy them anymore.
Right. I'm kind of at the same point you are. So I'm assuming that at least when I was tying a lot of flies, they were like $2 to $3. And so, I mean, tying with brass, probably $2 to $3 a pack. I can't imagine much more than that, maybe $3.50, but you get 24 beads. And then if you want the same amount of tungsten, you know, if you want a comparable tungsten pack, it's usually half the amount of beads. So it's not even 12, it's probably closer to 10 beads or maybe 20 beads if you're lucky, but then it's double or triple the price. And so it's very daunting to get into it, but and something I didn't want to do. It's kind of like using fluorocarbon, because you can buy a spool of mono for $5 or you can buy fluorocarbon for $15. You think, why would I ever buy fluorocarbon? But once you start using these products and they price, you know, and you're willing to bite the bullet and price it. And for me, it was essentially just getting to the age where I had a job and I could afford to do it on my own and not have to wait for birthdays or Christmas to get that kind of stuff. I was able to start buying tungsten and fluorocarbon and things like that. It made it a lot better. But like for a Frenchie, jig hooks are really big. I really like fulling mill hooks. That's just a personal preference of mine. But I also use some like wholesale hooks and like no name hooks, just buying them in bulk. And I haven't had any problems with them.
And people have said that before on here. Yeah. People have said they, that's a big tip is like, don't buy the cheap hooks because, you know, if you got this, a fish out there, they might bend out on you. Right.
Right. And so it's because of the whole, it's everything working together. And so like when I sell flies for people who go over, you know, overseas and out of the country, go abroad for GTs or peacocks or Dorado or whatever, you know, bass, pike, any of that, anyways, I never understand the idea of buying really cheap bargain basement flies to go and do that. You're spending thousands of dollars to go on these trips. Some people, it's the trip of their lifetime. Sometimes it's the big trip of the year. Sometimes it's the big trip of 10 years. And you think, all right, I'll spend $2 a fly. And then you'll go and try to fish for Dorados or peacocks or GTs or something, you know, serious like that. And you get the big one. And that's a weak point in your setup. It's like, it doesn't make any sense to be willing to spend all that money on a trip but not spend the money on the fly. But it's done more often than not. And so when it comes down to like a urine hooking setup, everything about it is all tied together. It's something that I noticed over doing it is the rod is very important. The line is important. The leader is very important. The diameter of tippet and the type of tippet's important. The hook's important. The bead's important. How you cast and drop the fly, the hook gauge makes a difference.
How important is the fly on these in your own nymphing?
As far as like what the fly is, it's not. So it doesn't matter if it's like the French Euro waltz worm.
So it doesn't really matter. So why would you want to, you know, why do they have all these different patterns? It seems like you could just put on any pattern. Is that do you find that the case?
No, I mean, you can put certain patterns work better. So for example, when I'm on the Crooked, I fish a lot of Betis imitations because the Crooked River over here in Central Oregon has a lot of Betis on it and the fish tend to respond to it really, really well.
What would be a Betis Euro nymph?
So like an Iron Lotus is a really good version of it. That's another Lance Egan fly. I really like his flies. He's done a really good job with it. So Lance Egan's Iron Lotus is one of my personal favorites on the river.
Okay.
And then I also use like a Silver Bullet Betis, which is essentially a thread Frenchie with very specific color patterns. It's an olive and black fly.
What is a Betis? Is that
a Betis?
Mayfly?
Yeah, mayfly, like blue wing olive. So it's in the same family as that. So if you have a river that has a lot of blue wing olives, so mostly out here in the West, a lot of tailwaters have high amount of Betis nymphs in them, as you're aware, Dave. And so they have that, and then pale morning duns is probably the next most common mayfly that I see that's consistent during the summer and consistent throughout the year.
Yeah, let's start there with just the, say, you know, we're talking about some popular flies. If you had to say somebody who's never been Euro nymphing, they're just going to be going out on some river around the country or world, you know, what are say 10 or the top flies you'd say if they're just going to pick Euro nymphs they want to use? Like you mentioned a couple. You got the Iron Lotus, you got the Frenchie, you got anything. Oh, I'm not sure what else you've said there, but could you give us that? Yeah.
Yeah, so I really like waltz worms. They're just, I really, really like them. And so a lot of guys on the East Coast and a lot of guys in Europe will fill entire boxes with just waltz worms of different sizes and thicknesses and thinnesses and weights and bead sizes to hook ratios. They'll just fill three or four fly boxes and just put thousands of them in their pack, and that's all they'll fish. And so that's a really impressionistic pattern, and so I like that one a lot. And there's a lot of customizing to it. So if you were to buy a waltz worm in like a fly shop, it'd probably be a couple bucks, but it's probably just a silver bead with hare's ear on a hook.
Yeah, and I'll put
it's very simple.
I'll put a link to anything we're talking about in the show notes so people can take a look at it. So if you have a waltz worm, Iron Lotus, a Frenchie, anything else we want to throw this list?
Oh yeah. So I just pulled up my presentation I do for some clubs about Euro nymphing, and I have a whole thing on flies. And so another good one that I like a lot is as far as a general, like,
mm-hmm. just
like
general,
like a chassis to build your fly off of.
Yep.
is a tag nymph.
And it might be easier, Garrett, just as time, because we're going to probably run out of time here in a half an hour, just to maybe walk through the flies, and then I'll put a link to all these so people can dig into a little more as far as what they look like and things like that.
Yeah. So as I said, so a tag nymph, it's like a CDC soft tackle with a bright tag. And then a paradigon is something I really like, and you can tie it into different variations. You can tie them bright, or you can tie them dull. That was a great fly last weekend when I was out fishing on the Deschutes. That fly crushed. I really like a Rainbow Warrior, a Duracell. So those two different flies, Duracells and Rainbow Warriors. A Polish pheasant tail is really nice. It's a less bright version of a Frenchie. And then as far as stone flies go, Pat Stone in a golden stone color, at least in my area, is awesome. But they sell this stone fly chenille now, and it comes in, I think, 10 different colors. So it just match it to whatever your fish tend to like. And then I'd probably say maybe a squirmy, which I know is blasphemous. Everyone in my fly tying group gives me, you know, they really bust me on that one. They give me a pretty hard time about it because I'm the youngest guy in my fly tying group by quite a few years. And so when I tie a squirmy or they give me a hard time about it, it's funny, but it's a great fly in the winter on a specific river near me. It's just something about it works. So I really like fishing that. And I don't know how many flies I'm up to now, but I probably...
You got 10. You hit it.
All right. Okay, yeah.
If we want to get more, we could dig in more to your... well, where would you send people if they want to dig in more to what you have going? Is that presentation out there online? Anywhere people can...
No. So I've just been doing it for clubs in lieu of having expos and shows to go to the last 2 years.
Are you doing clubs mostly in Oregon or around the country?
Oregon, Washington have been mostly where I've been doing them, just because those people either know me or know of me, or another club has pulled them. So, for example, I'm doing a presentation in Sisters, because coming up here in June, and then I have another one that's a Zoom presentation in Washington. So both of those are coming up in June, and I'm only doing the Sisters one because I did two presentations for the Sun River Club, and the Sun River Club talked to the Sisters Club. And
so if somebody wanted to look out, say, way out into maybe, you know, later in the summer, so when this goes out, they can maybe follow up or maybe even watch it on Zoom. Is there any clubs out there coming up that you'd note?
Currently not at the moment, but if they're part of a club and they want more information, feel free to reach out to me, and I'm willing to do stuff. The Zoom has made it much more accessible for a lot of clubs because they don't have to worry about logistics of getting the presenter out to them. They can just do it on a Tuesday night at 7 kind of thing. And so that's what I've been doing, or something similar to that. And so, that's probably the best way if you like the presentation version. Otherwise it's direct contact through me, through like my email.
We'll have contacts.
Social media.
We'll have the contacts in the, on the blog post. People can connect with you real easy. So let's just dig into a little more on the fly. I mean, you've mentioned, you know, we got 10 flies now, and the Frenchie is obviously one of the most popular ones. Is there one you want to pick out that you think is one of your favorites and talk about kind of materials? Like, so if somebody's going to get into tying Euro nymphs and they have, say they don't have anything, and they want to get some material so they can tie Euro nymphs, what do you recommend? Do they just get normal nymph materials, or do they have to get specific stuff?
So normal nymph materials is fine. And so like pheasant tail, I'd get a few different colors of pheasant tail, and even some colors you wouldn't think. So like I really like dyed brown, even though the natural is brown. I like the dyed brown a lot. I like gray a lot in pheasant tails, but those are like some variations. But like a big material that is used in a lot of flies is coque de leon, which is used as a tailing material. It's a very durable tailing material, and then it has a great coloration to it. So it's not monochromatic. It has a lot of speckling and barring, and it's really durable. So guys in the Euro nymphing world really, really like it, and I'm one of them. I really like coque de leon. It's a great material. So you use it on stuff like a Frenchie, a Duracell, Tungsten Surveyor, a Polish pheasant tail.
How many strands do you put in that? Are you typically putting just a few or a lot?
Probably around 6, I don't know, pieces. I would say hurls, but they're not a hurl, but like 6 individual...
Strands, or not strands, but yeah, fibers.
Tips.
I guess. Tips.
Yeah, 6 fibers.
Where do you start when you get this hook? So you've got this hook, which is and what is the hook? Are you using A-Rex, or what are your hooks? What's your, if somebody wanted to get the exact model...
If people are wanting to fish the same kind of hooks I use, Fulling Mill is what I tend to tell people.
Right.
For the price and for the style, it's they're pretty hard to beat.
What's the, is there a number or type if they want to get the, like, say they want to tie a...
Oh gosh. Yeah, I can find it for you real fast, but it's their jig hook is what I use a lot.
Okay. And what about sizes? Do you have a certain size, or is there, how many different sizes are you tying? Like if you had, say, the Frenchie or the Lotus, the Iron Lotus, I mean, are you tying, how small are you going and how big are you going?
So for example, the most Uranimphene hooks don't get below an 18. 18 is pretty small in the Uranimphene world, just in general, because of, you have to have a fly big enough to have enough weight on it to be able to sink at the right speed and depth that you're trying to fish. And if you go too small at that point, the weight becomes less significant. So the smaller you get, the less difference you have between tungsten and brass, for example. Like, I mean, a 1.5 millimeter bead is very similar in size to a, I mean, in density or in weight to a tungsten to a brass at that size. So 18 is pretty small. I tie mostly 16s, 14s, and 12s.
Okay,
12, it's just something that 12, I
14,
do.
16s. Okay, so we got 12s, 14s, 16s, and then yeah, when you see that jig hook, we can talk about that. But it's a pretty specialized hook, right? And it is a fulling milled jig hook.
Right, it's a fulling milled jig hook. Their code is an FM5045. It's their jig force.
Okay, cool. I'll put a,
and it's,
yeah.
And so yeah, it's a 60 degree jig hook. It's designed to ride hook point up when you put a slotted tungsten bead on there. So you're going to need a tungsten bead, and they only sell slotted tungsten. They don't sell a slotted brass bead.
And what are the slotted tungsten beads you're using? Is there a company and size? And like, so let's just break it down. Let's say that 14 will take the middle. So you're tying a size 14 with that hook. What bead are you using?
So a lot of people, so that's the thing in Uranimphene, is, which is really cool. When you use a jig hook, you can oversize and undersize your bead really easily. And so if you're fishing shallow water, you might want some flies with smaller beads, where if you're fishing really deep water, you might want some oversized beads. But I would say the middle of the road for me, what I like is like a 3.3, a 3.5 millimeter bead, which comes out to about a 1/8 size if you're using the imperial measurements over metric. But because it's called Uranimphene, everybody uses a metric system now. It's something I've switched over. I use millimeters now for all my bead sizes. It's hard for me to think of them in the imperial measurements now, because A, the millimeters are way easier to visualize for me compared to like 3/32 or 7/64.
We don't want to. That's kind of craziness anyways. We do a wacky system.
So I would say the 3.2 that fulling mill sells is pretty great. I just pulled a pack out of my drawer.
So 3.2 for a size 14, then you can go up or down from that depending on how shallow, right, or deep. So if you're fishing some tiny riffles, you might go, what would be the next, how small might you go on that if you're tying a 14 on millimeters? How much smaller?
Oh, probably maybe a 2 millimeter. That's pretty small.
Okay, two. So we got two. All right. So that gets us the bead, and then on the tail. So let's just say we're going with the Cote de Leon tail, and then and then I'm not sure what fly you mentioned. Which fly has the Cote de Leon tail?
A few, but we were kind of talking about the Frenchie, and so I've been kind of focusing on that one. And so you have the bead, you have the hook. Those are probably the most expensive part of your fly, and then you have the Cote de Leon tail. And Cote de Leon sometimes gets hard to find just because so many people like it and there's only so many birds in the world. So they'll run, like recently they ran out, probably in the late winter, they ran out of Cote de Leon tailing packs from Whiting, but you could still get Cote de Leon from like Hairline and other dealers that get it from Spain, and they get it from birds that molt the feathers. So the feathers just naturally fall off, and then they collect those and then they sell them. So you can get them. They just range in price. The most economical way to do it probably would be buying like a full saddle or a full neck of Cote de Leon. They're anywhere from like $25 to $40, but you can get a ton of others.
So we got the Cote de Leon, and then we got the body material is pheasant tail.
Yeah, and so on the classic Frenchie, Lance Egan's Frenchie, he uses melanistic pheasant, which is impossible to find. So the substitute to that is gray pheasant tail, so dyed gray pheasant tail. And I buy that usually I buy a lot of that when I need it. So it's just something that I like, because I don't want to run out of it when I tie the fly. So that's the body.
Okay, that's the body. And then it's wrapped with a copper wire, right?
Yeah. So yeah, so I counter wrap the pheasant tail. So I wrap the pheasant tail the opposite direction I wrap my thread. And then I wrap the copper wire, which I use small copper wire, not brassy or anything like that. I use pretty small, thin copper wire. And I wrapped it the same direction of my thread. And the reason behind that is for durability. But if you counter wrap the copper wire, when you go to tie it off, your thread will tend to push the copper wire a little bit. And therefore, it puts in slack into the copper wire. And then that slack translates through the whole body. And then the copper wire becomes loose, and then it can break off. So if you wrap the copper wire the same way you wrap your thread, when you wrap your thread and your copper wire together, it just tightens it even more.
Oh, okay. So you're basically counter wrapping the pheasant tail.
Correct, because it's a weaker fiber.
Gotcha. So, okay. So you counter wrap the pheasant tail, and then you wrap the copper wire the same as your thread. That way, when you wrap it, tie it off, it actually is secure. Is there any other tricks when you tie it off? Do you do like just the helicopter bend on that, or how do you do that?
Yeah. So that's the thing. If you counter wrap your copper wire and you go to do the helicopter and you don't tie it down tight enough with your thread, you're just putting more and more slack in there. And then when you put all that slack, that's when you get these flies that don't act as durable. And you'll tie a fly or you'll buy a fly and you'll think to yourself, why did this fall apart after, you know, three fish? It's probably because they wrapped the copper wire the opposite direction they wrapped their thread, and they've just created like micro slack in it. So one of the things I've picked up is I'm an electrician currently. I'm transitioning out of that job, but I'm an electrician. And one of the things they talk about when you wrap copper, you know, the copper wire around a screw on like an outlet or something, they want you to go clockwise, because that's the same direction you tighten the screw. And so when the screw tightens, it tightens the loop of copper wire around that. So you get a much more secure connection. And that's just something that translates into fly tying. You want a secure connection. So you want to go the same direction of your torque. So of your thread. So then after that, you're going to want dubbing. And so the underbody of this obviously is just thread, and you're trying to keep this as thin as possible. So you want to tie everything in chunks. So I'm tying in the tail material as I go down. I'm tying in both the pheasant tail and copper wire as I go up. Then I'm wrapping those materials up and then tying them off. And then for the collar, the traditional pattern, or say traditional, the original pattern calls for UV shrimp pink ice dub, and it's very specific. It's from Hairline, and the reason why is that is one of those I would say magic materials but it's kind of like peacock curl or pheasant tail or white goose biots, something about UV pink shrimp ice dub, which actually looks more orange than pink.
Yeah, it's cool. It looks sweet.
It's very buggy. It has a lot of, like, it throws light in a very unique way that there's not a lot of materials out there that do it. And so there's like a running joke through Fly Fish Food, where Lance Egan works now, and they would put shrimp pink ice dub on any fly just to see if it would make it better. And it does. It's a great material. So I'll blend it in with other dubbing, or I'll use it on its own on certain flies. It works really, really, really well. And so, if you go through my social media or go through any of my stuff where I'm out, you know, doing fly tying things, you can tie whole boxes of Frenchies of different colors. So you can change up the tail, the body, the collar, and then the hot spot color. And you can change all those independently of each other.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And I'm looking, I remember I had, I think it was Curtis on a while back. He noted, and I think they still do this with the Fly Fish Food. I'll put a link to this Frenchie, but I think you can go down, and if you go to that post, you can put select all, you know, for the materials, and you can just instantly buy, you know what I mean? So if you want to get all these, that's a cool thing that those guys do. And I'm not sure, probably there's probably more people doing that now.
Would hope so. It seems like a great way to make a lot of money. So
in fact, we're coming out. We've got a new sponsor. I'm just kind of thinking in the future now, when this comes out, we won't have them, but we've got a company up in Canada that's a fly tying company that we're going to be coming this fall. I'll talk to them more about to make sure they have that same capability, because that's definitely a great thing to have to make it easy. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah. And, you know, so we got, that's kind of the fly. You got a hot spot, basically. You got the, I guess it's orange or pink thread,
Red. I really like red as a hotspot.
Yeah, ultra. Or what are you using for thread?
I'm using Vivus. I love Vivus thread. And so I'm using, so that's the working thread of the whole fly. And then I do a pretty defined collar on the fly. And the reason why I like red in particular is it seems to catch fish really well. It's not super bright, but it's not dull. It doesn't fluoresce, but it's not invisible. It's just, I think it adds a lot of contrast. And I think fish like that. But red thread is kind of special. I was talking to somebody else about it, and it's just something about it.
Perfect. So that's kind of the Frenchie. What about when you get to these flies where they're more of the slick back body or kind of doing the UV? Can you talk about one of those? One of the flies you mentioned, do any of those have those flies where they're wrapped, the body's more of that clean? Maybe the Paragon, or I can't remember.
Yeah, Paragon. And so, interestingly enough, because I'm part of your a Facebook group, one of them is the Wet Fly Swing Facebook group, and yep. You asked something about, you're interviewing Deschutes Angler. I forget her name.
Yeah, yeah, Amy.
So you probably have interviewed her already at this point, yeah. And probably even already asked her my question by the time this show comes out. But I asked about the Glow Bright Blue Paratagon, and that's something that, so because of who I'm associated with in the fly fishing world, I tie flies with a few guys that work at Hairline. And I was at a fly tying group, this was pre-COVID, eating dinner with him, and he mentioned that Deschutes Angler was buying fluorescent blue Glow Bright out of House and Home. They're buying tons and tons of it so they can tie this Paratagon that they tie and they fish on the Deschutes, and they were crushing fish on it. And so I heard him say that, and I went, all right, I'll give it a go. So I bought some of the same material, and I tied a few flies left in my box, and that fly is a sleeper. That thing catches so many fish.
That's awesome. I'll put a link to that if I can get time when I edit this. I'll put a link into Amy's answer so we can listen to it. I'll also put a link out to that website or that episode as well.
Yeah, that fly is really, really good. I use it on a tailwater that flows right through town. I live right on the South San Diego River or right by it. It's like 5 minutes from my house. And it's just, all it is the body is a silver bead on a jig hook. And so it's the tail is very sparse coque de leon. So you're using anywhere between 3 to 4 fibers. You're using very little on the tailing material. So instead of using something thicker, like on a Frenchie, you're using very thin on a Paratagon, because Paratagon is Spanish for pellet. And so it's not pellet like a food pellet. It's pellet like a shotgun BB. So almost like pellet like a BB. So when you type in Paratagon into Google, it shows you like a shotgun with its pellets poured out of it. And so it sinks like a little lead ball, because it's a tungsten bead and then a thin tail, and then you wrap the body up with whatever material. So if we're using the Glow Bright version, I put Glow Bright on a spool. It's a single strand floss, and I wrap it up, taper the body a tiny bit towards the bead, tie it off, and then I add a hot spot to that, which is crazy. It's a very bright fly. I put an orange collar on it, just like they do over on the Deschutes. And then I'm coating that entire fly with a thin UV resin. So something like, I really like Solarez, I think it's called Bone Dry. It's their thin, which I really, really like that. But I used Loon Flow for a while. Deer Creek has one. I mean, there's a ton of UV resins out there now. But the Solarez is really, really nice. And so I put just one coat of that on there. And then if it needs another coat, I do another one. Because it's a porous material. It's not like using like a synthetic flash. It'll soak it up. So you'll probably put one coat on there, let it cure, put a second coat on, and then it should be good to go. And it's a very, very simple fly. Like, there's three materials if you include the thread. So, but the trick to those, what I've noticed, is no matter what kind of UV light you have, the flies sometimes end up either a little, they feel like they're still wet almost, or like a little tacky sometimes. Bone Dry is pretty good about not leaving any tack behind. But what I have found is what I do is I call cooking the fly. I take the fly box or the flies all lined up or something like that, and I put it in the windowsill just for a couple hours or a day when it's sunny out. And that time on the sun, because how, from what my understanding is, and I don't know how accurate this is, but every UV resin has a different wavelength of light that it cures with. And so you get these, you get the light, whatever brand you have. You may have like a Loon light or a Deer Creek light or an off-brand light or a laser, and it'll cure it, but it'll cure it 90% of the way. And then if you use the Deer Creek light with Deer Creek material or Loon light with Loon material, it should go 100%. But even then, I don't really notice it get to 100%. So when you get put in the sun has every light spectrum that you need. And so it definitely cures it completely. And so it takes away that almost, it makes it feel correct. It doesn't feel wet and slippery. It feels slippery because it's just a slippery material. And it doesn't feel tacky, like it didn't dry all the way. It feels like it's dry. And so that's what I do. I take my Paragon box that I have and I'll put in the windowsill for while I go run errands. The sun hits it and then the sun moves on, and then take it out and everything's rock solid.
Yep. Gotcha. That's a good tip. Okay. So yeah, anything else as far as, I mean, we've talked a little about tying. These are pretty basic tying. You know, I mean, anything else you want to throw out there that we should be thinking about?
Yeah. I would say experiment with colors on them, because one of the flies that I like that is not super well known is a tag nymph, and I call it a purple and copper. And the body's like a dark black, the bead's a copper bead, and then all the accents and like hot spots are purple with a CDC collar. And that fly, there's no one like bragging about this fly. A tag nymph is very similar to like a blowtorch or a red dart, but this is just my color version of those flies. And that fly does really, really well for me. I was fishing it. I mean, it's one of my confidence flies. It's a fly I'll put on if I don't know anything. I was on the middle of the shoots last weekend, and while I was on the middle of the shoots, that was one of the first flies I tied on. And I caught a fish or two, but then I switched over to Paragons because it seems like they're into mayflies more, and I caught a ton of fish on that. But this fly is, experiment with colors and different variations. Expand your horizons on where to get inspiration. So I was mentioning in the last presentation I gave last month about where I find fly patterns I like to tie, is I follow a lot of American fly tires, but I follow a ton of European and a ton of Australian fly tires, not just for Euro nymphing, but just for anything. And granted, there's a lot of Euro nymph patterns in their bunch of flies, but like, IB and Andy, which is a YouTube channel over in England, they have some great still water flies that I really like, and they have a lot of Euro nymph flies that I like. I really like, Crazy About Fly Fishing, I think, is a New Zealand or an Australian YouTube channel that has stuff. And then Fly Shop Europe and Kite Hooks, and I'm trying to think, Lindsay Simpson is a Scottish angler, has a ton of cool patterns. And so I pull a lot of inspiration from them. And so there's a fly that I started tying, and I have it in on my desk right now, but I call it a Kiwi nymph because I didn't know the name of it. I just saw it in one of their videos. I paused the video, I took a screenshot of it, and then I tied the fly based on that screenshot. And it's this really cool bright pink bead hot spot, like caddis fly that I really, really like. And so it's not sold stateside. I can't find it anywhere. So it's something about, you just have to kind of look in under, just like you're looking for bugs on a river, you should be looking for bugs on the internet the same way. You should lift over rocks and look around for them, because there's some really cool patterns out there that no one's tying over here.
Cool. Yeah, that fly is, I'm just looking at the tag nymph. So that's more of a, is that typically a peacock body, or is the body change?
So I do, let me see here. So I do a lot of dubbing bodies on mine. So for example, I use either thread or dubbing or like a quill. I've done that before, but, or even peacock curl, but, mostly dubbing. So I'm using different types of ice dub, and then I make a custom dub of hare's ear. So the way I do that is I take a hare's mask and just buy a hare's mask at the store. And then I shave the mask. I cut everything off. I take away the whiskers, but I cut all the hair off the mask. And then I sit here with a coffee grinder and grind it in batches to blend it all together. and then I add either a custom blend of Hair's Ear and Antron, or I cut my own Antron yarn up and then blend it in as well. And that's my Hair's Ear that I use. And it dubs unbelievably well, and it looks really good in the water, and it's very buggy, but not so buggy. It's not like squirrel. It's not such a guard hair heavy material, but it's not a, but it still has the guard hairs, but it's soft enough to still dub, because some of the, like, I would say store-bought Hair's Ears are so coarse, you can't even dub them on your thread. And the, when you custom blend it yourself, it's soft enough to dub onto your thread. So I do stuff like that, or I use, like, for example, the purple and copper, that's ice dub. That's just a blend of ice dub.
Well, let's take it out of here in the 222, which is top tips, flies, and resources. And maybe, you know, you mentioned, we've talked about a lot of them, but if you had to say, you know, tomorrow you're hitting, say, the, you know, your home water, whatever, you know, what are two you'd kind of be thinking about?
So, yeah, so I actually am going to go fishing tomorrow up on a local water. I'll go with that. I'd say the two flies I'd probably have on, based on my last fishing trip, just based on that alone, I'd probably have an orange light bright Perdigon as probably my top fly, and then my anchor fly, depending on the water flows and how much the water's moving, I'd probably either have like a tag nymph or maybe a waltz worm with a light pink bead. If you can find a metallic light pink bead somewhere, Folium Mill carries it, Hairline carries it, but they're kind of hard to find because I think a lot of people are realizing that they catch a lot of fish. There's something about a light pink metallic bead that catches a lot of fish. And so I probably do like a J.P. Newberry's waltz worm that he does. I think he calls it like a sexy Betty or a sexy waltz or something like that. So I put that as my point fly, my anchor fly, and then I might have a Perdigon as my top fly, like a light bright orange.
Perfect. And all, yeah, and Devin and Lance, I think, both talked about some of the setups on how to do it. I'll put links to that so people can follow up there. And so, and then what about tips? So if you're out there and we're talking tying, so let's just think of fly tying. Any fly tying tips, either Euro nymphing specific or just in general?
So I mentioned a couple, which was, you know, wrapping your strengthening material, whatever that may be, if it's copper wire or monofilament or whatever, wrap that the same direction as your thread to strengthen it. That was a good one, but I'll try to give two more. I would say less is more when it comes to UV resin. You don't need a ton. You want to go as light as you possibly can, because what will happen and what will get away from you is you'll put some on the fly and it will start to sag in any particular direction. And you want to go less is more. And so don't be afraid to take some off. Don't be afraid to wipe it off. Don't be afraid to use the liquid tension that it has to like pull more material away, and then cure it, and then put even a lighter coat over the top of that. That's something that
I've had a lot. Multiple coats.
Yeah, you either go super. If you want it thicker, don't do one big blob. Do a couple coats to get to the thickness you want, and even then, you don't need a ton. You really need as little as possible. So, like if you're tying a Copper John, that's a classic epoxy or UV resin fly, the tendency is to take a big old glob of it and plop it on. And so what's best is not even a glob, but just a light coating of something super thin, and then cure it, and then maybe do one more coat to fill in the gaps, and then cure it with that, because it will look cleaner, it will sink better, it won't tumble as much or twist as much because everything's all in line. So that would be a good tip with the UV resin. And then if you want to still to kind of stay in the same vein of that is when you use any a pigmented resin, because that's become very popular nowadays, either from Gulf or Rapids, like, or Loon has some, and Solarez has some of these pigmented resins that are different colors. That pigment is awesome, but it also inhibits the curing process because it doesn't allow it creates some opacity. It's not as transparent as obviously clear resin. And so be mindful when you're using that. I got in trouble using black UV resin and I put a big blob of it on there and then the surface would cure, but underneath would not. So go super thin with it, get as thin as you can. And then also the tip I'd give with that, besides just going thin, like I did do with normal resin, is put it down on a different surface, like a sticky notepad, and then use either your bodkin or a toothpick or something to pick it up so you have a lot more control with that material. Because when you have it just on the brush or squeezing out of a bottle, you might squeeze too much. There might be an air pocket in there. I've had it sometimes, which is, it's terrible when it happens, but you'll have, you'll feel like you wiped off the brush, but there's like a drop on the shaft of the brush. And as you're putting a little drop on the fly, that drop runs down the shaft of the brush into the bristles, and then it lands on your fly, and then you have this big old black blob on your fly, or pink blob, or chartreuse blob, or whatever color you pigment you have. So I always take it and put it on something like a little piece of foil, or a sticky notepad, or the upside down of like one of those cups you get at like a takeout place. You know, those like sauce cups. I bought a bunch of those on Amazon, so I'll turn one upside down and then I'll put like a little drop on there, and I'll pick that up with a toothpick or a bodkin. And it just helps your control, because again, the thing you'll hear from almost every competitor in the world, from domestic guys like Norm McTima and Lance Egan and Devin Olsen, and even European and Australian and all those guys, is thin, 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 thin.
Yeah, if you're thin tying to win. Your flies, thin to win.
Yeah. That's it. That applies to everything. Thin leaders, thin tippet, small tippet rings, thin flies. It's huge. I until you start fishing a bunch with them and you can start telling the difference and feeling the difference, a thin fly makes a massive difference.
Perfect. Perfect. And you mentioned a number of resources. You want to just highlight a couple there, that, you know, as far as you're nymphing with the focus on fly tying?
Yeah, with the focus on fly tying, obviously, Fly Fish Food, we mentioned them a bunch. And then just pull on that thread, and that'll take you to a lot of places. A good overseas tire that I'm sure everyone knows is Davy McPhail. He does a ton of stuff. And I grew up learning how to tie flies from him, essentially. Him and Jay Nicholas.
Yeah,
and
those are two good guys.
Those are really good guys. But for Euro nymphing specifically, let me see here. There's a few guys out there that are really good, and so that I always try to like clock in and check. And so,
like through like YouTube mostly.
Yeah, I'm doing a lot of stuff through YouTube. This is where I learn. But like books that I like are like Devin Olsen's book, Tactical Fly Fishing, is really good. Has a few patterns in there. That's something that I would push on to anybody. And so for a YouTube channel, Lindsey Simpson is really good. He sounds like Sean Connery, so it's awesome.
Cool.
His fly tying videos. Trying to think here if there's anybody else that like just jumps out at me that produces it. It makes it hard.
That gives us plenty of firepower for sure, I think. I mean, you've mentioned a number of great people. So I'll put links out to everything we talked about today. And I guess, the best place, Garrett, to find you is just OregonFlyTying.com or are you on Instagram, Garrett Lesko?
Yeah, just Garrett Lesko on Instagram. And then you can find me on Facebook too as well. And then if you message me through either one of those locations or go through the website, just email me. My email is just GarrettLesko@gmail.com. So it's just my name at Gmail.
Okay. Perfect. And you mentioned, so you're 26 now?
Yes. Yeah, just 20, turned 26, 26 a couple weeks ago.
So yeah, that's right. That's right. Because I remember seeing you, I think, at some of the Albany shows, and I can't remember how long. It seems like that's been an ancient time ago when we did that because of COVID. But I guess it's been a couple years, right?
Yeah, it's been 2 years now. And the thing was, is when I reached out to you initially, I think we know a lot of the same people, but just not, we just never knew each other. So like I've mentioned Jay Nicholas, and I become pretty close friends with Jay. And then like I know I've gotten into the Atlantic salmon fly and like old traditional steelhead world because of my mentor, Garen Wood. And so Dave McNeese, I've become pretty close with Dave McNeese.
Yep.
And there's just people that I've just met over the years that, turns out what something I've learned, at least in fly fishing, is everybody, knows someone, And so we probably know a lot of the same people. And
It's a small world.
Very small world. I got to keep reminding myself about that. Fly fishing is very small, but it's fun. It's awesome.
Oh yeah.
It's cool that it's a small world.
Yeah. And I try to keep it, you know, my focus when I think about listeners is, you know, I try to think of really North America. You know, that's kind of the bigger area with, you know, we have people that listen around the world as well. So I try to, you know, probably some of the people you talked about as far as kind of Europe, you know, there's people listening now that are over there and, you know, they may not have fished here before. I do have a cool, well, see, I guess Charles Jardine, he's already been on. I'll put a link to that as well. He's kind of, people call him the Lefty Cray of the UK. But, you know, there's just some cool, there's a lot of great people out there. There's no way I'm going to connect and interview all of them. So no, I appreciate you coming on here. Before we get out of here, Garrett, just give us, I always love to get a little taste of the music. What you know, when you're tying flies or you listen to, do you have a band or a type of music you like?
So, I listen to a lot of music, a lot of different types of music. And I say I listen to just about everything. And so I kind of go through phases. And so my girlfriend and I actually went through a phase where we're really into Marty Robbins.
Oh, yeah.
For like a long time.
Now, Marty Robbins is, that's like country, old country.
Yeah, old country ballads. And I'm not a country guy at all. Like, I don't listen to country hardly ever. And so, but I really liked him. And so I listened to that for a while. But if I had to pick any, if I'm tuning the radio, it kind of depends on my mood. But it tends to be either just like top 40 or like classic rock. I like really 70s and 80s rock a lot. So I do that. And then every once in a while, I'll listen to like Spanish music. So I listen to like tune to a local Spanish station in the summertime. And I don't understand it like hardly at all. But it's just, it has good energy when you got the windows down, it's really hot out, you're driving to the fishing spot. It has that energy that I like with that. But most music I listen to, like, I really like Queen. Queen's a great, I love Queen. I love Rat. If you've listened to Rat at all, Round and Round and Straight Out of the Cell, those are great. Like that hair metal kind of metal stuff.
Oh yeah. There's Rat. Some of those bands like Rat, they don't necessarily have do they have one song that people would know of?
Probably Round and Round.
Oh yeah, Round and Round. That's right.
Yeah, or like Deep Purple. I'm trying to think. Like, for being 26, it's a pretty deep pull for all this stuff. But like Blackboard. Like, yeah, I like music like that. It's I know the lyrics for that. It's fun. They're short songs. You know, they had to fit on an LP at the time, so they had to be, you know, in that 2 minute. And so it's good. My dad's a huge audiophile, and so I've gotten a lot of music from him. You know, his favorite band is Rush, and so I listen to a lot of Rush too. And so
there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all links and everything else we covered today, just head over to wetflyswing.com/236. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it on social and leave a 5-star review if you get a chance on whatever app you're on right now. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/love. That'll quickly allow you to click over and leave a review on a few of the big apps out there. I want to thank you in advance if you have been able to do that. I'm going to bust out of here quick and get on to the next one because I still got some more editing to do. So I'm going to be going on and moving to the next one pretty quick. So definitely I want to thank you again for sticking around and hopefully maybe catch up with you on the river or maybe online.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.